When someone is about to retire from a winery, they're in a special place to talk about their work. Already in their mind, they've been considering for a while what has been important, what they've accomplished, what they're passing on. And they tend to see a larger context for events and to hone in on what was really of consequence to them, to the winery as a whole. They might be thinking about the sacrifices that were made, or maybe even some of the surprises that came about. As Hanno Zilliken prepares to retire, we got him to sit down and discuss a half century of winemaking in the Czar. It maybe wasn't easy for Hanno, and he's far from a self-promoter or a loud person. But I think you'll see, as I did during the interview, just what defines him: determination, a firmness about his beliefs, but also not taking anything for granted, a quiet demeanor. He speaks with the dedication of a craftsman, and with the memory of someone who was fully involved in the fine details of each vintage that he worked. It's also clear that he constantly wanted to produce better and better wines, not for the money or for the fame, but because that's what he considered to be the right thing to do. And he feels lucky that he had had the chance to do so. If you'd like to sample what Hanno has been up to all these years, I have an opportunity for you. There's a special deal available to you from one of Hanno's last vintages and from the vineyard site that he is really known for. The 2013 Zilliken Saarburger Roche Cabinet Riesling is only $26.95 for a limited time. The great team at Crush Wine and Spirits is offering a discount on the 2013 cabinet so that the pricing comes down over 15% from the normal price. You just need to call them at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTT for me, or use that same promo code online at crushwineco.com. Just remember to give Crush the offer code IDTTFORME when it comes time to place your order. Hanno Zilliken knows what he's doing, as you're about to hear for yourself. To take advantage of some great pricing on the wine that he made, call Crush Wine and Spirits and ask for the special deal available to podcast listeners. 750, which is very simply the greatest resource for wholesale wine buyers on the planet, is available in many states, very probably yours. Are you a buyer in Alabama, California, Colorado, Connecticut, D.C., Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, that's right, both Carolinas, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, or Virginia? Then 750 is for you. It will help you organize, it will help you sort, it will help you find what you need, and it will save you time. 750 has what you need to do your work better. Check out 750.com. There are so many powerful features, you'll start to wonder how you ever got along without it. 750.com. Find today what you'll want to drink tomorrow. I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
Last year, I was on a mid-German crystalline high. And this high was pretty awesome.
Did she just say she was high?
Now, it may sound like I was doing something illegal, but no, I was just standing on a geologic formation known as the Mid-German Crystalline High.
Mid-German Crystalline High.
In fact, in a way, we can thank this crystalline high for the Mosel wines, because thanks to a collision with this continental plate fragment, we have the unique slate soils of the Mosel River Valley. The Mosel and its tributaries wind to and fro throughout the slate outcropping. But the Mosel wasn't always full of bends, and the ground wasn't always made of slate. Million years ago, the Mosel area was a shallow sea with a thick bed of sedimentary mud and clay. The earth was warm, and there weren't many glaciers around. This made the sea level higher, and much of today's land was submersed. But when tectonic plate activity increased, and the land masses collided, they pushed into each other and created pressure and heat that caused the sea floor sediments to chemically morph into slate. Pressure between plates also caused buckling on the Earth's surface and created several mountains and hilly regions. The Mosel slate rose up, and eventually a long, flat, wide Mosel River passed through it. Over time, the river formed sharp bends and turns. Lots of sea creatures once lived in what is now the modern-day Mosel, and they've left behind countless fossils in the region. You can find a particular type of slate in many regions of the Mosel called Devonian or Devon slate. The Devonian slate is extremely rich in fossils. It's one of the few areas in the world where you can find pyrite fossils. You'll see what looks like gold starfish embedded in the slate. And because of the special and swift way that the fossils were formed, these are some of the few fossils where we can see the soft tissue of creatures that lived hundreds of millions of years ago. Many of the fossils that make up the extraordinary collections from the Mosel area were discovered by miners. The Romans used slate from here, and we see the first evidence of commercial mining in the 1300s. By the 18th century, a slate boom was in play, and people throughout Europe wanted slate roof tiles, slate floor tiles, slate wall decorations, slate headstones, and slate chalkboards. The slate business did well until about 30 years ago, when globalization saw the sourcing of slate move to other countries. Mosel slate is prized by vintners today, and each different type of slate imparts different characteristics in the wine. Devonian slate, in particular, contains no lime, so you get a different characteristic in the wine, which a lot of people describe as dense and stony. Devonian slate is also 400 million years old. It's really old. So it breaks down easily and infuses any surrounding soil with minerals. This mineral-rich environment changes the way the vines feed, and you get a special wine from this type of slate. Recently, in the Mosel, Saar, and Ruhr, you'll see producers labeling their different slate types, or in German, Schiefer, by color or category. Roter Schiefer is red slate, Grauen Schiefer refers to a gray slate origin, and more, you're seeing the word Devon or Devonian Schiefer referring to this special Devon slate. One producer who has a terroir gold mine is Hanno Zilliken, who makes wines from the Saarburger Rausch, a Devonian slate outcropping that has a unique volcanic diabase vein that runs through it. This makes the grapes incredibly distinctive before he and his daughter even begin the winemaking process. Trying one of his aged Saarburger Rausch wines from Devonian slate just might give you, a different kind of crystalline high.
Recently, I attended a tasting of small grower coffees sourced by Damour, a micro roaster that specializes in finding and shipping rare, high-quality coffee beans from around the world. I was so impressed by the scope of the Damour project that I spoke with founder Jennifer Stone about the length she goes to preserve the quality of the coffee beans she purchases for roasting.
The first thing I'm looking for is things gone wrong, defects. So moldy bean, rotten bean, sour bean, something called a Quaker, which is a bean that just never develops. All those things can give the cup an off note. So that's what I'm looking for first off. A lot of things can go wrong. From the farmer can do an amazing job picking the coffee, processing it, bagging it, and then it can go off to the it goes to the mill, then it goes to dock, basically jumps on a container and floats to wherever whoever's purchased it. And things can happen, like if the container ship isn't leaving that day that he expects it to, and it can just sit in the hot sun. So you can taste that when it gets here. So, the coffee level that I deal with, you would never find that. Specialty grade is the top grade of coffee. That's green coffee beans, raw coffee beans that have zero defects per 350 grams. And a defect is, again, that stick, stone, moldy bean, rotten bean, fungus, excessive bug bites. A lot of beans can get crushed in the process. And so if there's too many of those, it affects the cup quality. And then we go down to premium grade, which is really more ubiquitous. It's probably what you're seeing around the city quite a bit. In that grade, you're allowed to have two defects. And then you have exchange grade, below grade, off grade. So those are still what we call Arabica coffee, which is the species. And you'll hear that used a lot in marketing.
A lot. Yeah, you hear that a lot.
Arabica. But that doesn't mean it's good. It just means it's grown at a certain altitude or it's a certain species of coffee. So what I've done with this new line we're talking about, Damour, is taking that specialty standard and really created my own set of higher standards that encompass the quality level. Things like, yeah, altitude and variety are important. But for me, I'm looking for complexity of flavor, first and foremost. Coffee that has a distinct taste. To anyone should be able to taste these distinctions, the beginning, the middle, the end, and then an aftertaste. And then I'm also looking for an inherent sweetness that through our particular roasting style we can highlight. It's really the benchmarks of Café Privé Select.
To find out more details about Damour and to purchase small lot, high quality roasted beans for your own use, go to damourcoffee.com. That's damourcoffee.com. DEMOURSCOFFEE.com. And experience a whole new world of coffee. And it's Hanno Zilliken is your name.
Yeah, that's my nickname. My name in the passport is Hans Joachim.
And where did you grow up?
In Saarburg. That's a pretty old town in the absolute western part of Germany, near the border of Luxembourg, you can see. It's not far away.
What was your childhood like?
Yeah, I'm going to school in Saarburg, born in Saarburg. And in these days, in my when I was a schoolboy, we still are living in a rented house because our original building is destroyed and the new one is not rebuilt.
It was destroyed in a war.
Yeah, the Second World War. It was, Saarburg was a part of the defense line of the West Wall. And Christmas 44, many bombs destroy houses and the bridge in Saarburg. And the pity was that our old estate building directly is placed beside the bridge they destroy. And so we lost it.
What was the condition of your family at that time?
Yeah, it was a special tough time in these days because it's often an up and down in the winery. And maybe I can start with my personal feeling, and then we will come to the story of the winery. So in school, I've told you that I like to be always in nature. And on the end, I decide to be a grower and winemaker. But in our estate, there we have a special situation. We are part of a special rule called Höferrolle. That's a German word. And there, only the oldest kid can or should take over. And I'm the second kid. And it was planned that my oldest brother, Stephen, will take over.
He was going to inherit the estate.
Yeah, that's later. Huh? And so I think, good, I will be a winemaker somewhere. While Stephen will run the winery.
You knew you wanted to work with wine.
Yeah. And then it's also a rare thing that two brothers are studying on the same time in Geisenheim. The same semesters, the same time, and we finished on the same time.
What was your brother like?
He's looking like me, or what?
So he was smart, school, and helped you with studies, or...?
Yeah, he has maybe a more open character. He is I'm more closed or quiet, I will say. And but Stephen was a very open-minded person. And after the studying in Geisenheim, he learned he met his later wife, Anne. And Anna is coming from a winery in Nittel. It's on the border of Luxembourg, around 15 kilometers from Saarburg. And she feel in love with my brother, and they are looking for a man in their company. my brother decide to switch over in the other winery.
He went to his wife's winery.
Yeah, and in the same time, he is asking me if I will take over the father's winery.
Oh, I see. So that opened up the family winery for you.
That's for me. It is now a new chance. And so I decided to go this way.
What was the condition of that winery at the time?
Yeah, my father has, my mother died in 70, and we finished the Geisenheim studying in 72. So he was a man without a wife. And in this time, my sister, Ela, or Gabriele, she is 15 years old, and she stopped and going to school, and she is cooking for us, for washing for us, and she is a great character. And later, she has a chance to go to school again. Then she is today chemical assistant. Yeah, we are very happy that is going on in this way. But 2 years later, in I think it was 72, my father married a second time. And his second wife died after 22 years. So it is a other dimension. She died in 99. And now he is 16 years again alone. You know? And he is still alive, just turning 95.
And he made wine.
And he is the one, he married my mother after the war. But before I will tell this story, I must go back to the winery Forstmeister Gels. It's a winery now more than 270 years in the family. Myself, I am the 10th generation. And Forstmeister Gels was one of these family members 100 years ago. He was in this time Royal Prussian Forstmeister. And besides this profession, he is running the winery. And he was a founding member of the VDP. And for a sign of tradition, we still carry the name. And so he has had two daughters. And my grandmother, it was Ella Gels. And my aunt, great aunt, was Henriette Gels. And the story is that he divide the winery not in exactly 50-50. My great aunt Antoinette, she married a military major. And in this time, it was a royal time. It was normal that when such a major will marry, he has to marry a wife with a special amount of money or land or and such thing. And so it was a little bit more than half she get. So she was a perfect marriage for this major. So my great mother Ella owns maybe 40% of the winery. But my grandmother married Forstmeister in the eastern of Germany and switch over. And so my aunt Antoinette runs the complete winery. And then in the time or after the time there in eastern Germany, my grandfather, Forstmeister Haring, died. My grandmother, Ella, died. And so my mother, together with her sister, are while the war alone. And my mother remember her parts of the winery in Saarburg, and come back from Eastern Germany in the war. And she thinks, oh, that's my future. And she take over her parts of the winery. And in a very tough time, I remember there a story just behind the wall. They have no money, they have no material to cultivate the damaged vineyards. And they are collecting electricity wires, things from the west wall to have material to bind the vines. And that's a story I remember often, and say when we have sometimes a tough situation, was in these days a much tougher one. Mm-hmm. So the lucky thing is in 48 he is marrying. And after this time, they both built up the winery again. Step by step, they have had four kids. My oldest brother, Stephen, me, my sister, Gabriele, and Rainer, the youngest. And the pity is Rainer died when two trains are pushing together in the neighborhood of Saarburg. And it was 75. So it was a very tough time also for my father. He has lost in 70 his first wife, my mother, and in 75 his youngest son. And so, yeah, he was a good character. Yeah, then I decide to go on in the winery.
In 76.
Yeah. 76, I'm ready with my time by the military. I was a parachutist. And
you jumped out of planes.
Yeah. And after this time, I was in Saarburg. And my father is a very generous man. He say, so you have learned making wine. You have studied in Geisenheim. And it is only possible that one person is responsible for making wine. And we can discuss together, we can taste together, but I decide you should be the responsible person. It's a great challenge. And especially when we will have the 76 vintage, directly a great one. And so 76 was my first vintage for Cellarmaster, together with my father, sure. But I was directly involved, and I was very, I like to do something special. And we select BA and TBA in this vintage. And it's the first since a long time. 59 was the last one.
There had been no BA before.
Yeah. There was a 71 BA, yeah, but not a TBA. And so...
So you made a conscious effort to pick later than had been happening for a while.
Yeah, and I have a goal to make something special.
You wanted something great.
Yeah, and I was hot. I will do something special. And yeah, this vintage 1976 offers this chance, and I got it. Yeah, then different vintages and up and down is following. Especially in the 80s, we have an extremely up and down. We have had the vintage 80. Yeah, that's the poorest vintage after the war. The smallest yield with only two barrels, that means 2,000 liter per hectare. And without one exception, it is only basic wine, Cuvée. And this one exception is a very special one. It is a ice wine cabinet. Unusual today, but in these days, it was allowed to combine a predicat with the ice wine. And it is made by half-frozen grapes. Maybe the starting must wait was, it was the best vineyard spot in the Rausch. We are harvesting maybe by... Before frosted, it was 70, 71 Grad Oechsle, so pretty small. And this little frost rise up the must weight in maybe quite 90. And so that's something special. It's an extract of this poor vintage. And we can make a whole barrel, 1,000 liters. And because I have to do something special, Dorothy, my daughter, my oldest daughter, is born in 80. And I always say nature is needing all its power to bring Dorothy. And there was no power left for the vineyard and the vintage. And we still have pleasure in opening bottles of this 80 ice wine. It shows today the green components. The acids are not so ripe and the herbal notes. But the wine is showing absolute freshness today. So it can last with its high extract easily 50 years more, I think. It will not never be weak. The residual sugar, it was around 50. It is completely dried out. The wine is tasting absolute dry by an acidity of around 11.5. So it's a, I always say it is a curiosity. It is a studying object, but never it is a great wine. But it was a specialty of the poor vintage 80.
It was a wine that you made to commemorate your daughter's birth, but that her child may drink. It's lived that long.
Yeah. Yeah, then the great, the unusual rich 82 happens. And we, you can say we bring in a double harvest. And it makes problems. We haven't had enough barrels and we have to sell juice. Otherwise, we cannot harvest everything.
The opposite problem of it.
Yeah, and this. And by medium quality of the vintage. And even in this vintage, I have had the luck to get a specialty, a very late harvest ice wine, 31 December. And of this vintage, and I'm sure there are not much concentrated examples of this poor vintage or tricky vintage 82. Yeah, next vintage again, the 83. For us, it was a great gift. For me, it was the start. It opens me many chances. I have building plans and so on. And it was with this vintage, I was especially successful here in the United States. And from this time, I have the contact with Rudy Wiest of Cellars International. We still have this contact, and it is my agent here in the country. And yeah, he has accompanied my whole cellar master or my life there for cellar master.
So the whole time you've been making wine, he's represented the wines in the States.
Yeah, yeah.
And States is a big market for you.
For us, it is a very important market. There are many years where it is, from the volume, the absolute biggest one.
And then continuing on from 83, what were the vintages that you
found? I remember, then, for example, it's also to explain this extremely up and down. In 83, this generous vintage, we have many, many Auslese, only a few cabinet and no basic wine. And in 84, the next vintage, we haven't had any predicat wines, not a cabinet. It's all basic wine. So it's such an up and down is can happen.
So it's almost that one vintage seems to lead into another by giving you the opposite.
Yeah, and it shows that nature is not constant, and especially the Saar area is a growing area with extremes. We are, one side, we are more south than the middle Mosel, but higher in altitude. And the valleys are not so deep cutted than the Mosel valleys. And wind and weather can reach our vineyards easier. The valleys are more open. And so we have a more rough climate. And that means maybe half a degree C less temperature. And in poor years, it is a tough thing to have this condition. For example, in the 80s, we have had the 80, the 84, the 87 poor vintages, and where we have still green herbal notes in the wine. But it opens on the other side in good and rich vintages, the chance to have still lively structure in the wines. When you think about vintages like 59 or 76, very hot and ripe vintages, the Saar offers always this brilliant, lively play between fruit acidity. And before we have too much sun, I think other growing regions have more problems.
But it must have been an interesting time to learn with so many different kinds of vintages as you're getting started.
Yeah, it's an extreme up and down. And soon happened, or in this time, I was just married in 79. We have had an extreme harvest. The winter between 78 and 79 was bringing outstanding temperature change. Oh. From 10 degree C plus, it turns in one night to 20 degree C minus, 30 grad Celsius. And so the wet wines are burst by the frost, and there are a lot of old wines broken. And so the harvest in 79 was small again.
How are you developing as a winemaker? What did you see in your own technique? Did it change year to year to meet the conditions, or?
Yeah, the goal was always been the same. But the techniques, the possibilities, and the knowledge and the experience about, they will help to find more precision again. What has changed to my father is that we are doing other job in the vineyard. You have to know, after the war, the first goal was to bring in some fruit and are not looking for top wines. They have more buds on each wine, and they use fertilizer to reach this goal. But, with the time, especially in the 70s, there it's starting, we are looking for more and more finesse and concentration in the wine, and I reduce the branches, especially after 82 vintages. There we have had only two canes, and later today we only have one cane and some eyes, some buds.
So you reduce the yields from your father's generation.
Extremely, and we are not using any fertilizer more. We are only when fertilizer, it is, we do use humus and mulch, organic material. So there is a more constant ripening possible. That's the first thing we change. And then we are selecting harder and harder, knowing that only by this system we can reach very special wines.
And what were the vineyard parcels that you began with, and what are they today?
The size we are cultivating has been, in the time where I take over, nearly the same. I start with around 10 hectares. Today we are cultivating 11 hectares. But today we are owning of the father most of these parcels. In the time before, several parcels are rented.
And you're mostly in the Saarburger Rausch.
Yeah.
And tell me a little bit about that vineyard.
That's our domain with around 10 hectares of the total size of 20 hectares today. There we will find a very fine sintplated slate, a Devonian slate, soft, you can break with your hand, and other mineral, eruption mineral called diabas. It is pushing in a liquid form through the sediments of the Devon slate and get hard on the surface. It was not active volcano. Then we have had lava and basalt. So here it was getting hard on the surface and stops. And the color is green and blue, and it is hard and heavy like basalt. But together with the weathered slate is responsible for this precise minerality you will find in all our wines.
There's a mineral tone, but then also a sort of a richness of fruit at the same time.
Yeah, but the richness of the fruit can see very precise in climbing must weights. When we reach a must weight of 90 and more, we have more and more intense tropical notes in our wines, like mango, pineapple, lychee, and so on. You can see in the Spätlese we are offering today. And that's the stadium where we have reached fully ripeness, golden berries, just before they get a thin skin and start shriveling. And when we like to select, again, higher concentrations, we have to select this shriveled material. One side it is air-dried, one side it is botrytis.
And you also own a parcel in a different vineyard.
Yeah, that's the other great vineyard we are cultivating. It is Ochfner Bockstein, but there we are owning only 1 hectare. And the Bockstein wines are different. Primarily, the minerals are different. When you compare the slate to the Saarburger vineyard, here in Ochfen, we can find a more gravelly, harder slate and quartzite and a yellow loam for fine earth. And with this terroir, the wines are, in comparing to the Rausch, more open, easier to come in. And so with the Bockstein wines, we can demonstrate maybe how the Rausch wines will go for.
But they're both vineyards in the Saar.
Yeah, so 3 kilometers distance between.
And how would you sum up the Saar as a viticultural zone in comparison to the greater Mosel?
I have told you about the higher altitude and the special climate. The results, when people ask me what's the difference between Mosel and Saar, I try to explain it in simple words. It is the different in the combination of all what there is in. A Mosel wine is built around its fruit. It is open. You can smell the young wine in a distance of maybe half a meter. And these wines are accompanied by a fine acidity. A Saar wine is built around its minerality and acidity and citrus aromas, these freshness components, I always call them. And it is accompanied by fine fruit. So the weight is here on the Saar and parts of the Ruwer, more on the refreshing side.
And what about the handling in the cellar? What happens when the grapes arrive at the winery?
In the cellar, in general, nothing has changed. We use still the German oak 1,000-liter barrels in a neutral style.
It's from German forest, the oak.
Yeah. And so today, when we buy a new barrel, we have to neutralize it first. Therefore, we use a lot of time. We use watering, we steam them, and we put in the cleaning water, the yeast water from the racking. And with this, we get the first contact with the wood, and by this, we pull out the mainly tannin. And when we use these barrels after the second year for making wine, we use them only a short time. So we are very careful because we are not liking a barrique style in our wines. So before pressing, it's important to know we are pressing the material we are harvesting over the day. Directly, we don't use any maceration.
No skin contact.
So short as possible. And because the goal is the leanness, the weightless structure in these wines. And when you think about The maceration, you get more white, you get more horizontal aromas, some intensity, but we like the lean structure. And so we follow this line that we pressing directly, then we let sediment the juice overnight in the pressing room. And therefore, we use a stainless steel tank, but only one night. Then we let down by gravity the juice in the barrels to ferment. And you must know our cellar is something very special. We have a three-story deep cellar, and the lowest cellar offers constant temperature. It is made by extremely humidity. We have creeks there, and we have stalactites on the roof. It is dropping constantly. Everything is wet. And it you can see this extreme humidity. When we fill up a barrel, it keeps full. We never have to top it. There's no evaporation. No evaporation. And when you know that constantly or always wet wood is more hermetic than dry one, we can use these barrels in a very individual style, but in a reductive style, not oxidized.
So even though it's winemaking with wood, it's reductive?
It can be reductive when we have such situations. When you have a warm and dry cellar, you risk that the wines will oxidize earlier.
And that's not what you want, because you're going for a long aging style.
The way we are working is that the time of contact with the wood is around 5 to 6 months. That's the basic ripeness these wines are needing. And then we are bottling, and we are bottling the complete vintage in one row.
So early bottling, in a way.
In March, April. And also a special thing, basing on this bottling in one row, is that we can bring all the bottles to the control to getting the AP number on the same time. And we decide that the highest concentration in the sweet or the noble sweet world will wear number one. That's the first, so one of the bottling year. And the next concentration is number two and so on. And that is helpful for the collectors when they will see two Auslesers of the same vintage with different numbers. And then they know the smaller number is nearer to the peak of the vintage. And when they see, here is a wine, maybe Auslese with AP number 5, they know there are 4 steps higher. There exist more 4 steps higher.
Wines that do a lot of their evolution in the bottle.
Yep.
And how long do you hold the bottles before you sell them?
The current, the basic wine, we offer just after bottling. For example, our butterfly or the dry versions in the basic wine. The next level, the Prädikat wines, we are selling after the Mainzer Weinbörse. It is in end of April, so early May, these wines are available. And later we offer the auction wines, or today also the Große Gewächs.
And everything is Riesling?
We have 100% Riesling, 100% steep south-facing hillsides, and each wine, even the basic wine, is fermented in German oak. And we don't buy any grapes and juice, and so we are working very individual.
And you said that one of the wines from 1980 you saw aging another 50 years. What's typical for the aging of your wines across the board? I mean, what do you find that you usually start to open them, and how long do they last in the cellar?
Yeah, the normal way of life is that they offer their primaire aromas in the beginning. And these primaire aromas are less and less intense with each year. With 4 or 5 years, they go to sleep. And then in our by our wines, you need a minimum time of 10 years that they will develop. And then they have many years in front before we reach a border where there is nothing between the acidity and the matureness left. So long there is something like with extract or fruit between, we have life, lively play. But in a really overripe or matured Riesling, there are only these two components left. That is the acidity standing there itself, and the Firne, the oldness, the matureness. But therefore, you have to wait many decades.
Kind of feels like it's nice to drink at the border, too, all those things going on.
Yeah, it is. So each period of developing has a special interesting. And I like very much the matured fruity wines I can combine with slightly spicy dishes. When you think about matches, it is a great experience to have, for example, dark meat, a wild boar, for example, with a really matured Auslese of 59, for example. It is a perfect match.
So you change the food to the style of the wine and its age.
Yeah, it is so that the wines have a different stadium, and you have to know this, and with this knowledge to have to use them. So I always say you have to be fair to the wine. It is unfair to open a bottle in the wrong age for the wrong situation.
Do you find that your wines develop a petrol character?
Very few only. And when it happened, it is only an addition to the complex structure, never dominating. And otherwise, we will lose this harmony and the balance. And while ripening, we think about this minimum age of 10 years, we have a more and more intense flavor too. The bouquet is more and more intense. It turns in often smokiness, but just the minerality is coming out again more precise, because in a young wine, often the primary aromas will cover the minerality, but when it is in the background, the minerality is more precise.
As you said, it's a form of reductive winemaking. Do you find it sometimes helpful to decant the wines?
Absolutely. Still, when we open today an 83 bottle, Auslese, it is so that the first impression is, oh, this smokiness, this matureness, but it is it will disappear with more and more air contact, and then the fruit is coming out. Today, the fruit of the 83, for example, it reminds on butter caramel taste beside the apricot and peach. But that's, for example, a vintage without any sign of petrol notes, the 83. While, for example, the 93 offers very fine petrol aromas.
And what about some of those other vintages of the 80s as they progressed along? What was your experience of 85 and 86?
85 was a good vintage. Between the 83 and the 89, it is something between.
One also, of the better vintages. Yep, 83, 85, 89 are the...
One of the better one. And we have had luck also to harvest ice wine in this year. In the 80s, it was nearly possible each second year. While today it is, we will not have the same chance by this global warming.
You've had a climate change and it's harder to make ice wine.
Yeah. And so 89 was again a very special wine. And there I remember the Auslese Long Gold Cap. In these days, we have had ice wine. It's a typical ice wine vintage. We have had a smaller ice wine and we have a Botrytis selection. And then we decide to blend it because 89 offers a very gentle acidity. And the ice wine, it lacks maybe a little bit on fruit. And so we decide to blend it. And so it was our auction Auslese. When it is, when you declassify both components in an Auslese level, then it is allowed to blend Auslese with Auslese. and I lose the right to name it BA or ice wine. And this we have made, and yeah.
But it was designed for an auction release.
Yeah.
And how does that work in terms of your wines? Is that a popular outlet for your wines?
Absolute. For us, the auction is very important to reach friends of specialties all over the world. These wines cannot fix in a regular offer because we have no idea where we should fix the price. When it is too low, it is directly sold out. And when it is too high, we cannot buy it. And so the auction was the perfect podium base to sell such wines.
Something that was a bit unique, and you weren't sure what the market would be for such a unique wine.
And it's also for me, with the success in auction wines, with these auction wines, it is again a motivation to produce something special, to look for something special. And that's also a special chance with our many different barrels. And so we have to do two main decisions. While harvesting, which grapes are coming in one selection, and after keeping all the results separate and mature them, on the end, in the spring, we have to decide how to bottle this material. Is it a perfect single barrel? We bottle it like this, or is it a perfect partner with this barrel and this barrel? For us, it is very simple. We have 100% Riesling, 90% is Rausch, and so it's it is always only this one vintage in the barrel cellar.
So Zilliken, or Forstmeister Geltz, as it was called at the time, was a founding member of the VDP.
Yeah.
What was the perception of Zilliken in the market from the 70s, 80s, 90s today?
Yeah, it is. I think my father has done a very important and good job in his time, but he has had quite difficult start after the war with this damaged vineyards, not in good shape, the cellar and estate building destroyed. Yeah, he has done a very good job in buying the cellar we are owning today. After the war, the first years, we are renting different cellars with our few barrels. Then he gets a chance to buy by auction a cellar building not ready yet. It is built in the 20s of the last century by one company, but they can't finish the building, and so it was a ruin for several decades.
It was a ruin.
Yeah, and in the Second World War, they use it for bomb shelter too, but never for making wine. And he gets the cellar, and with this we have had a start again, and step by step, we build up the winery again. And it's a very important time for the winery that the chain is not broken. And I must thank you, especially to my mother and my father, that they keep it and give me the chance to go on with much better conditions. And today, I think I can offer Dorsey, my daughter, she will take over next year. Again, quite other chances with a winery, I think many other growers will have.
The original building that you used as a cellar was the victim of bombing and destroyed.
Yeah.
Your father had to find space in other wineries for the wines.
Yeah, for the first years, he rented only cellars to have the place to mature the wines in the vintage 48, 49. And in early 50s, he can buy the today cellar.
So he purchases a previous bomb shelter, unfinished construction, and that's why it's a modern facility on top of your cellar.
Yeah, that's later. That's later. First, he built up a pressing room on this ruin. And so he has a pressing room and a cellar below. And later in 69, he built on this cellar the today's living house. And I do several steps in building. I built the new pressing room. The latest step we have done was finishing the tasting room. And with this now, we have a complete winery again. And to have a harmonious impression, I covered the building my father has built in 69 with a bigger isolation, new windows, new roof. And from outside today, everything is looking new and made in the same time.
So in a way, the restoration of winemaking facilities at the same time that you're purchasing the plots that you had been renting. Restoration of the estate on both the vineyards.
Yeah, the vineyards are nearly the same. We own today more of these holdings. And so we have a good chance to compare the results my father has matured with my own wines. And that's also nice for the wine lovers and collectors that we never change the style. We do a more and more precise job, but the style we don't change.
How would you describe that style?
I'll start with a goal we have. The goal is to produce one side finesse, and on the other side, the lightest impression such a finesse can offer. That means when we have Auslese with a gentle acidity, it will offers easier opulency. And we are happy to reach the selection where we have more acid in and to have the chance to build a wine with a more lively structure. And so I always explain, we like to offer wines with intensity and length, but you will never find heaviness in our wines.
Throughout the career of Zilliken, it's worked in the Prodigat system, Cabernet, Spätlese, Auslese, not going with the idea more of the QBA, you know, Hamann-Lowenstein kind of idea, but staying with the kind of classic Prodigat.
Yeah. It is so that we still have a percentage of around 50% fruity, noble, sweet wines in the winery. But in the last years, we have had more and more success also in offering dry versions.
GG stuff.
GGs, for example. We start with this VDP classification system in 2009. You have to know the VDP is creating this system maybe 12 or more years ago, but the members of the VDP, they have time to go in the system because each winery has other situations, other problems with this. And we decide to go in the system 2009 and directly we switch completely over in the sun. No anymore Spätlese dry or such things. Prädikats are today completely fruity and noble sweet, and the dry and medium dry wines, they are classified by another system. There you have to look for the description where the wine is coming from. The most simple description means that it's the simplest level, the basic wine, for example, the dry version called Zilliken Dry, and the next step is the village level, the Saarburger Riesling Dry. And we have a second step there. It is a Saarburger Riesling Dry Old Wines. And the peak is in the dry world, Rausch GG.
So no Spätlese truck and no Auslese truck and into
not,
GG
not anymore.
For anything dry.
We have had in the past. And this was interesting to compare these matured examples. There you can find, for example, 83 Spätlese Dry, unbelievable fresh today. And that make me sure that we will have also great aging potential in this precise GGs.
What's it like to try to make dry wines in the Saar? What's that like?
Yeah, it is so that my personal love is to combine wine with food. And for some mild dishes, here I need something with only few sweetness. Otherwise, the sweetness will be too dominant. And for this, why we are looking for making medium dry or dry versions. So knowing now that these dry examples can age also very good, we are storing also special sizes of the GGs for maybe a later release.
And what is the aging curve of something like a Rausch GG? I mean, when do I approach that wine?
Could here again, the very beginning, the charm of the young wine is attractive. The wine is more quiet later. And here we are looking for grapes fully ripened with less acid and to find a harmony in the wine while we are looking in the fruity or noble sweet wines for concentration with high acidities.
So maintaining the acidity in the sweet wines, but looking for more fruit in the dry wines.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's maybe why you'd start with a GG in 2009.
Yeah, yeah. And there we have the idea to use only the free ranges before pressing. And the fruit, the wine is offering near silky impression, very gentle. And you don't imagine or think about a sour Riesling.
Do Zillikon wines ever go through shutdown periods in either sweet or dry? Do they ever close for?
The typical closing time is between the young wine and the 10 years you have to have a minimum. But even in the matureness later with 20 and more years, you have things like waves. It is sometimes a little up and down. Also, when you store a bottle over so many years, each bottle will have its own life by its individual cork. And so it happens that you open a bottle and say, oh, I remember this in another way. Maybe I should look soon after a next chance to open a bottle of this wine. And then after the next chance, I say, oh, it should be maybe a single bottle, or it. I'm sure that in the moment this wine has a welly, or is in a welly.
And so what about the vintages of the 90s and the 2000s? What did you experience on those vintages?
There we have had with 97 vintage, a very special one for us, our favorites. And there, in far the most of the wines, we can find this tropical notes. And normally it will, or often it will disappear. But in the 97s, it keeps. And 97 was a vintage where we have nearly no welly. Like the vintage 75, it's a vintage always tasting good.
Oh, it's always, since release, it's always been good.
Yeah, and but we keep of the 97 sizes. I will have fun later with the wine.
And what other notable vintages from the 90s? What about 95 seem pretty good for you?
Yeah, 95 is a good vintage in this decade. Between the more minerally 94 and the lighter 96. And there's also a special story. We have bottled the Auslese number one. Remember my number system we are using since 93. And this number one, yeah, we like to offer by auction or perhaps for a gold cap. And we are not sure. And then the 96 is coming and 97. And we can say we forgot this wine or we prefer other auction wines. And so we keep it. And much later, that means last year, we offer this for a late release first. So all the time we have still all the bottles in the cellar. This wine directly was sold out. And with this matureness, the wine offers with its 18, 19 years, it find exactly the balance we are looking for. this lively play between fruit acidity and the fruit is completely integrated. It is melted together. We call it homogene. And most of this wine is gone to Great Britain. Yeah.
When did you start to see the effects of climate change in your region?
I think in the last decade, starting with 2003. It's also a vintage very... you can learn a lot about this vintage. So far, especially when you are looking in the dry wine world, the goal was the more concentrated, the higher the alcohol, the higher the concentration, the better the wine. The winemakers are proud to present 16% alcoholic white wine. And with this vintage, the mind is changing. They realize that it can be too much and that less can be more. And you have to look for the harmony, for the balance in the wine. And you have to offer invitation with the wine. And when you are after the first glass not liking to go on, there's something wrong.
You saw the end of what was possible. The extreme.
And it is a good experience for the cellar masters in general. And yeah, then one good and great year, one after the other, will follow. We never have had such a decade with so much great years.
01, 02, 04.
Yeah, and 04, 05, 07, 09. Mostly it is the unrare vintage. And good 2010 is a very special one between. But again, 11 was a fantastic vintage. And so with 2013, we have a break that we have a lighter vintage again. But a very special one. And now in 2014, we can offer the whole range again.
Which is something that was maybe more of a challenge in some of those years in the 2000s.
Yeah, and you have to see it. We growers on the Saar have to know that it is very dangerous to live from one year to the other. There is no constant line in. The up and down can happen, and the hole we have had with the small yield in vintage 2013, we can fill up with matured examples from younger days, like 11, but also 2009, and really matured wines too.
Were there vintages in the 2000s that you thought, this reminds me of a vintage from earlier in my career? Or did they all seem different in kind than what you're doing?
There are parallels that you can say this is a vintage reminds me on this and this, when you have nearly the same structure in, but never you will find an exactly same impression. For example, the absolute new vintage now, the 2014, reminds me personally in our state on the 11, because there we have nearly the same spectrum to offer now. And I know it is not the case everywhere.
So offering Cabernet through BA?
Not BA, no, but fine auslesers, auction wines. Yeah.
And then also GG.
Yeah, also GG.
And your daughter Dorothy decided to join you at the winery.
Yeah, that's right. And I have two daughters. And Dorothy is the oldest one. And yeah, she decided, oh, that's the profession I like to go for. And it was, since this time, absolute clear. She finished school and go to Geisenheim and finished school. And it was always clear that she will be a winemaker.
It must be satisfying for you to see the continuation of not just the family, but the winery and
yeah,
the family.
Absolutely. And Dorothy is marrying her husband, Philip. She keeps the name Silicon. Today it's possible, I'll do. And Philip is very generous. He is taking the name Silicon. Something unusual. And with this, I have got a late son.
And what do you tell your children about wine?
It is important to give over the feeling about wine, the experience we have in combination wine and food. And yeah, and it is great to see that in this younger generation there is no dictate anymore. We have had in the 80s with after the scandals in the 70s, we have had this dry wine dictate, and today it is more open-minded. The young generation is testing itself and discussing, and say they are able to say, though, that my personal love is this and not what is common. You know? But you have to say that also the wine in the dry style are changing. What we have sold in the 80s for dry wine in this time, I remember I think in the same wine, in the same way how I like to produce my fruity and noble sweet wines. I take material with high acidities and vinify dry. Oh, it is sometimes a tough result. And today, I think quite different. The goal is, before harvesting, to find the right material, to have golden grapes with absolute ripe acidity, and before chiveling.
As you get ready to retire, which you'll do soon,
It is so that the program, or what we have talking about in the family, is I always say, with reaching 60 or turning 65, I will retire, remembering my own taking over in 81. My father was 61 years, and I give up. And so I have no problems to give up with 65. But I like to help Dorsey and Philip as good I can, and I hope we can mature many different vintages in future. You need many years to give all the experience, all the knowledge over to the next generation. It's not possible by only three vintages.
What's the most important thing that you can tell them about making wine?
You only can do this job when you like what you are doing. And that's very important. And I'm looking for that the kids are realizing the nice parts of this job, the experiences, the great matches, the people they will meet with their wines, and so on. And not seeing only the sometimes tough work.
Looking back over your career, what are you most proud of?
That I had the luck that in my generation, for owner and cellar master, the family is belonging together, is stable, and that we have a harmony in the family. And that's, you have to have this climate to be creative.
Hanno Zilliken, he's building wines based on acidity and a winery based on family. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Hanno Zilliken of Forstmeister Gelst Zilliken. Hey, don't forget, if you want to pick up one of Hanno's wines, the 2013 Zilliken Saarburger Rausch Cabernet Riesling is only $26.95 a bottle at Crush Wine and Spirits for a limited time. You just need to use the offer code IDTT for me when you call them at 212-980-9463, or use that offer code IDTT for me at crushwineco.com. It's a special price, it's available to you as a podcast listener, and it's over 15% lower than the normal price. Give Crush a call and enjoy some of the wine that Hanno made for you. And that was our episode. Every week we like to give you two interviews with some of the most interesting people in wine. If you'd like to support the show, one of the most fundamental, helpful things you can do is go to iTunes and leave a review. Hopefully nice, thank you. That says why you like the show, but also just hook us up with some stars. And the whole point of that is The more people do that, the easier it is for other people to find the show. The way that the review process works, if a show is popular, iTunes recommends it to other people on a more frequent basis. So it's sort of like a winner-take-all situation. If you're already popular, it will make you more popular. If you're not popular at all, sucks to be you. Basically, we're sort of in the middle, and frankly, we could use your help. So if there's something else you had planned today, scratch that off the list and give us a fine 5-star review on iTunes, please. It would really help us out. I mean, it would help us out. Also, if you'd like to purchase a t-shirt, alldrinktothatpod.com has all the information on how to find yourself a t-shirt or bag or tank top with a I'll Drink to That logo on it. And if you'd like to shoot us a donation, we would really appreciate it. It helps. And a lot of people do it, but we could always use a few more. Thanks to those who have supported us so far. It's been a great, almost, what, 3-year run? Something like that? Still doing this. Still loving you all. Thanks for listening.